I'm J.G. Michael, and this is Parallax Views. On this edition of Parallax Views, futurist thinker and global resilience expert Vinay Gupta joins us for a wide-ranging discussion spanning topics like religion, philosophy, politics, including a critique of the left, and, of course, the current coronavirus pandemic, which was the initial reason I reached out to Vinay. As I said, he is a global resilience expert and as a result has spent a lot of time looking at the problem of pandemics. So that is why I initially reached out to Vinay, who I should add, for those that don't know, is also involved in the world of cryptocurrencies, something we've been very critical of on this program. Vinay helped launch Ethereum and now runs Materium, both involved in the world of blockchain and cryptocurrencies like Bitcoin. So this is an interesting conversation in that Vinay comes from a very different viewpoint than myself and my co-host, Casey. And in particular, a great deal of the conversation ends up being Vinay's critique of the left, which he feels is too heavily invested in identity politics. Now, I myself don't necessarily agree with Vinay's point of view on that topic. Vinay feels that the left has betrayed the idea of working class socialist solidarity by focusing too much on identity politics. I believe that we can strike a balance, that we can defend, for example, LGBT rights, as well as working for class solidarity. And in a way, I kind of wonder if Vinay and I really disagree that much, but we do have a little bit of a back and forth. This is not a debate show, so I kind of let Vinay have his say, push back a little when I feel, you know, a certain level of disagreement that I can't let go of. But in any case, I feel like it made for a rather fascinating conversation that will definitely live up to the title of being a Parallax View, not only for myself, but also you, the listeners. And of course, even if you feel a little bit uncomfortable with some of the discussion about the left and Vinay's critique of the left, I think as we get deeper into the conversation, to be rather specific, the point at which we pivot to the current pandemic, well, I think that Vinay has some really interesting insights to offer in regards to the pandemic and how it relates to class war. Those are his own words, that there is a class war element to the social tensions arising from the pandemic. And of course, I again would like to stress that this conversation is definitely going to be a Parallax View. So with that being said, let's dive right into the conversation with Vinay Gupta, futurist thinker and global resilience expert. Welcome to Parallax Views, Vinay Gupta of Materium. And also, you have a lot of projects, man, so we'll have to get into that. But how are you doing today, Vinay?
I'm all right. I'm all right. I'm in this sort of permanent weekend state, but I also tended to do a lot of work on the weekends. So I feel like I'm having like a Saturday without end. Like, oh, I'm going to get up, you know, I'm going to have some lunch, I'm going to do like 6 hours of calls and write a couple of things. And so, yeah, it feels like a permanent working Saturday. It's quite weird.
Mm-hmm. Well, I wanted to have you on initially.
Yeah, it's... Mm-hmm.
Go on, I'm sorry.
Oh, and yeah, I mean, I guess, I don't know how when this is going to come out, but this is what, April the 6th or something?
April 7th.
So right in the middle of this kind of lockdown period, which is a very strange liminal space.
Well, I initially actually wanted to have you on to talk about the pandemic because you've done a lot of work in relation to pandemics. But first, maybe for my listeners that are not as familiar with your work, maybe you could just give a little background on what you've been doing and some of your projects over the years.
So I usually do this chronologically. Started out as an engineer working on computer graphics for medical stuff and video games in the 1990s. Had a very heavy meditation practice from a young age, in my kind of mid-teens. Got on the spiritual track very hard when I came to America, found a guru, got enlightened, which is a whole other set of stories, in about 98. I was 26, just super young for enlightenment. Got about 2 years of regular civilian life where it was really just, you know, had a web design job in Chicago and everything was great. And then 6 months more between 6 months before 9/11, I had a vision about the end of the world, which is a weird thing to have. Picked up and moved to Colorado after 9/11, started working on energy policy associated with an outfit called Rocky Mountain Institute. And Rocky Mountain Institute was like the great center of understanding that you could still run a global economy with zero carbon. Mm-hmm. Like really advanced thinking, hardcore engineering, financial modeling. At that point, it was about 60 or 80 people. And that took my life in a completely different direction. I left tech. And I spent from then until 2014 almost entirely working on sustainability, resilience, energy, refugees, all this kind of Buckminster Fullery stuff, which also meant I spent a bunch of time working with the military. And then 2014, I was out of cash and out of patience, and I said, fuck this. And I went and took a job with the Ethereum Foundation project managing, put all my software skills back to work. And I've spent 5 years in the blockchain space trying to beat some sense into those fuckers with a shovel.
and
here
also,
we are.
I was going to mention in particular, you have the Hexier project. Maybe for my listeners that are unfamiliar with that, you could just give a brief rundown. I think it's a very interesting project pertaining to refugees.
Sure. So about 2002, I got asked whether I could figure out how to make a refugee house that can be flat packed on the back of a truck and moved with the refugees when they're resettled. So, you know, they run over a border because of civil war, they hang out in another country for a few years, the civil war goes away, but their villages have been burned down. How do you get them home again? So the idea was, how do you make a refugee shelter that would fold flat on a truck? And I had done 6 months of work on geodesic domes on the Buckminster Fuller designs in 95. I got a ton of work into it. 95, 96 is that winter. So I rolled out a bunch of that and came up with this thing called a Hexier, which is the simplest possible to build efficient shelter. Mm-hmm. So if you think of building it in plywood for a second, a lot of environments you wouldn't use plywood, but if you think plywood for a second, so you take 6 sheets of plywood and you put them on their sides on the ground and in a hexagon. So you have a wall that's 4 feet high and the hexagon is 16 feet across. Very simple wall, comes up to about mid-chest. Then you take 6 more sheets and you cut them in half on the diagonal, and then you put the 2 right-angled pieces back to back. So what you're doing is you're making a triangle, which is 8 feet wide and 8 feet high, and you've got 6 of these things from 6 sheets of plywood. You screw those together so they form a shallow cone, and then with about 15 people, you lift that cone up, march it over to the wall, drop it down, and then screw the 2 together with some little wooden blocks of shims. And that shelter will cost $250, maybe. They make many thousands a year of them every year for Burning Man. They improvise them out of insulation boards called polyiso. $13 a board at Home Depot. It's more probably more like 15 now. They hold them together with a tape, which is on sale all over America under the brand name Hexier Tape, because the burners use so much of the damn stuff that it's become a line item. You can actually order it from like tape warehouses. Hey, do you have any Hexier Tape? And they'll sell with this. And that whole model is embedded in a very different idea of what refugees are, because the current refugee shelters don't really plan on long-term resettlement. They don't plan on reusability for the shelters. It's a very short-term, quick-fix model. And this was a much more permanent model of saying, like, look, once people become refugees, they're going to be refugees for a generation in most cases. And we have to work with that, or you leave people completely hanging.
Mm-hmm. And I guess this sort of gets into an area that I wanted to cover with you before we get into the pandemic, and that's that I would say that you're a very, very much into humanitarianism. You're also very interesting ideologically. In a way, I don't know where to place you because you're not like a libertarian in the way that most of us think of libertarians, but you're not a socialist. We were talking about that before we got on air. You're not really down with the Bernie revolution. You're a very original sort of thinker.
Well, to be honest, I'm only really original for Europeans and Americans, right? For Indians, I'm completely derivative, right? I talk about this stuff with Indians. They're like, Prout. I'm like, yeah, kinda. So there's an Indian religious movement, which is a kind of neighbor to my group, called Ananda Marga. And Ananda Marga, it offices in about 80 countries. They do large-scale humanitarian stuff. And their founder, Shushi Anandamurthy, basically had a political philosophy which was really fully informed by both capitalism and communism, took elements from both and combined them in a way that was very much embedded in Indian political philosophy. Mm-hmm. So I am by no means an expert in Prout, but the broad principles basically suggest that you want to run capitalism and communism in the same economy. But what's interesting about that is it's not a kind of market communism approach. What they suggest is that large-scale enterprises and natural monopolies should be run by the government as monopolies, mm-hmm. right? So that's your power company, that's your, maybe internet provision in some areas, anything which is just extremely large-scale, provision of roads, right? Roads, power, mm-hmm. all the rest of that stuff, done by the state. One tier down, large enterprises over a few hundred employees, all employee-owned. And the idea is that the employee-owned is progressive. So, you gradually have to transfer more and more and more ownership of the enterprise to the employees as the enterprise scales. And then small-scale stuff, they say pretty much unregulated capitalist free enterprise. Because the point that they're making is that for the small stuff, if you've got no access to political power, the market actually operates kind of sort of how you want it to operate. But the larger things get, the more opportunity they've got for application of coercive force until you get to the monopolies, which might as well be the government. So if you're going to get control, it has to be democratic control. The other really radical idea that's a core part of the Prout ideology is the idea of wealth cap. So for ordinary people, your wealth cap is, I don't know, some random number. It's maybe as much money as you could spend in 10 years. And you're just not able to own more money than that, right? Any more money than that automatically goes to the state and is redistributed. But if people have done something completely outstanding, they can be awarded a higher wealth cap basically as a sort of mark of outstanding social service. So you take somebody like J.K. Rowling, it's like, so many people love your books and want to read your books that we're going to increase your wealth cap because at the end of the day, you're not harming anybody by making this money. But it takes away the incentive for a lot of kinds of evil, because if you're going to be, screwing people very badly by doubling their insulin price every 3 months, at a certain point, you've made all the money you can on that because you're just not allowed to make any money and you should now basically sod off. Mm-hmm. So it's quite a clever mechanism because it gets rid of a lot of the worst attributes of the kind of capitalist sociopathic model just by saying to people like, look, once you hit the wealth cap, you've won the game. Now please bugger off. So there's all kinds of clever things in the Prout model, and I'm probably butchering it here. I'm sure that like proper Prout people would laugh at my description of it, but you know, that sort of thinking and those kind of mechanisms are much more visible inside of Indian political thought than maybe they are over here.
Mm-hmm.
The Indian, you know, Indian politics is very much its own beast because of all of it gets, you know, fundamentally is, you know, there's pre-Gandhi and there's post-Gandhi, and everything post-Gandhi has, you know, spinning wheels kind of tucked away in all of the corners, and it assumes relocalization as a priority. It assumes that capital is useful when distributed and poisonous when concentrated. So there's a whole decentralization thing which is baked into there.
Mm-hmm.
Also very different models of freedom. So Western models of freedom, you've got kings and you've got barons, and the barons are asserting their freedom against the kings, and then gradually more and more people try and get kind of baronial freedom. Whereas again, in an Indian model, freedom is much more taken from the tradition of the sadhus, who are, you know, wandering holy men covered in ash, you know, carrying like nothing but a water pot and maybe a carrot. And, you know, those guys are seen as being completely free. So it's not like, oh, we're all going to be free like barons. It's a different model of free.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, I'm definitely a chip off a particular set of old blocks, but they're very not European or American.
And I know you also wanted to mention that you were saying before we started recording that spirituality and particularly meditation has played a role in a lot of your path in life.
Yeah. I mean, Ananda Marga is explicitly a religious movement. I'm not a member of the Marga, but most of my politics are definitely inspired by their thinking. The group that I am a part of is a thing called the Nath Sampradaya. So the Naths are a kind of crazy, I mean, frankly, they're astonishingly right wing right now. Right. But you know, they're a crazy right-wing Hindu death cult that has tucked itself up in the mountains of Nepal for a thousand years. Prior to that, it was very much a broad-based yogic movement. Very anarchist, very antinomian, against all forms of caste, against all forms of social hierarchy, plenty of female teachers. Two of my three big teachers in this tradition have been women. So I got onto the meditation track when I was a teenager, studied extremely hard, more than an hour a day for 8 or 9 years, had a bunch of weird mystical experiences. Having read Karl Popper and Thomas Kuhn when I was a teenager, I'm very aware of just because you experienced it doesn't mean it's real. So I hold all of my religious experiences as very much like I had the experience, and I'm not going to assume that what happened to me is any more reliable than what happened to the guy down the street that tells you he was abducted by Martians.
Mm-hmm.
Right? So I think it's quite important to be able to have a category of like, it happened to me, but that doesn't mean that what I saw is objectively real. So yeah, I mean, kind of a weird position, you know, one foot in the Western scientific model, one foot in the Indian mystical model. But I'm not kind of the naive, like, oh, you know, it's all the same thing in the end. Like, Western scientific knowing is a better kind of knowing for almost all issues than the kind of meditation introspection type of knowing. But the issues, like, the Western model has no issues for fixing being,
mm-hmm.
right? So the way that we experience reality at rest, the Western model has really no way of changing. And that's what the Indian model specializes in. Mm-hmm. In is how do we get inside of your head and make it possible to be at rest and not be in pain? And that's a major achievement. Like, that really unlocks the world in a very deep way. So I did tons of that stuff. And then when I had this weird vision when I was just in spring of 2001, a few months before 9/11, I had this weird vision about, oh my God, the world is going to die. And that really kicked me into high gear.
Mm-hmm.
But the thing that I want to communicate here is, like, it's a statement of fact that I had a weird vision, right? Nothing after that point is a statement of fact, and it's got no objective relevance or reality to anybody else.
Mm-hmm.
So although I have very strong religious beliefs and I've had very strong religious experiences, I don't consider any of that to be referencing external reality. And I think this is quite a subtle thing, because, you know, like, Western religion references external reality and tries to tell you that it's physics.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Indian religion might reference external reality a bit. Buddhism particularly goes into that track a bit. that Hinduism, you know, is very much just like, well, what did the universe say to you? Well, it said this to me. What did the universe say to him? Well, it said something else to him. Why did the universe not say the same thing to both of us? I don't know. You should ask it if you see it again. Mm-hmm. Right? Like, there's no notion of orthodoxy, and there's no notion of objectivity to the vast majority of the religious traditions inside of Hinduism. Mm-hmm. So it's possible in Hinduism to be very religious and also to have practically no faith. Right? There's a famous Indian religious teacher called Ganesh Baba, and Ganesh Baba has a famous prayer. Oh God, if there is a God, please help us if you can help us. Right? And this coming from a guy in orange robes who's a big Swami, right? So it's kind of, you know, if you're part of that school of thought in Indian traditions, mm-hmm. it's very much experiential. It's very much about changing your relationship with reality at a fundamental level. But nowhere along that way does anybody hand you a guidebook and some certainty. You know, it's like a very advanced class in not really understanding anything and having to become okay with that. Why are we here? Much closer in a lot of ways to French existentialism. So imagine
if Sartre, yeah.
Yeah, right. So imagine if Sartre had been 5,000 years ago and had written a bunch of books and that had become mainstreamed as a religion. Mm-hmm. Right? So there's a wing of Hinduism which is extraordinarily close to existentialism, largely because existentialism was a retelling of those truths in a Western market. Mm-hmm. And that sort of existential branch of Hinduism is basically like, look, you know, if you can tell me a single thing which is incontrovertibly true, I'll mm-hmm. change my mind about everything. But when you try and answer those kind of questions, what you discover is that everything is built on everything else. Mm-hmm. And at the end of it, you kind of have to be like, well, we're just going to play this how it lies, because how are we going to find an objective frame of reference? Mm-hmm. So it's a fundamental terminating of objectivity as a goal that results in a kind of cognitive freedom. Mm-hmm. But is that religion? Is that philosophy? Is it cognitive psychology? You know, it's a million miles away from anything that you would describe as a religion relative to things like mm-hmm. Judaism, Christianity, or Islam. Because it's a religion which is pretty much defined by its access to uncertainty.
Well, I think we've done a good job laying the groundwork for maybe my listeners being able to understand the point of view that you're coming from. I guess
I can practically hear them walk into their fridges to get another beer. Like, oh, this is going to be a long night. the hell even is that? Hello.
As I told you before we were recording, a lot of my listeners lean very much to the left. I do have some libertarian guests on and other ideologies on. I'm curious, since we were talking about it off air, what are your main sort of disagreements with the left? It sounds like a lot of it has to do with you have the same sort of humanitarian goals in mind, but you believe the ends or the way to meet those ends is very different.
Yeah. So, I mean, my fundamental issue is that I think Marx has really profoundly screwed us. Right. So I think enormous amounts of the fundamental toxicity in the world come from Marx. And this is a tricky thing, right? So, if you think of, like, do you know Buckminster Fuller, American engineer, philosopher?
Yeah, I like Fuller a lot, yeah.
Yeah, so if you try and implement the ideas of Buckminster Fuller, most of the time what you will get is either a working geodesic dome or a bunch of crap lying on the ground. Mm-hmm. Right? It's pretty much fail-safe, and it largely fails in the off position. Mm-hmm. You know, you don't get sudden, like, Buckminster Fuller cults that grow up and trash a bunch of stuff. On the other hand, Marxism, you take the ideas of Marx and you apply them, and it turns out that a really disturbing number of monkeys wind up building death cults around Marx. And that is not necessarily Marx's fault. That's probably far more an issue with the human race rather than with Marx's analysis. But the combination of, you know, Marx plus monkeys tends to equal, like, huge death cults. And, you know, we've seen that a number of times. So then we say, okay, why is this happening? And yeah, there could be any amount of analysis about, you know, freedom under communism, yada, yada, yada. But the one thing that I think I'm completely confident of is that if Marx was writing today, Marx wouldn't say any of the same stuff. Mm-hmm. Right? Like, you know, capitalism has taken on a completely different aspect really since the invention of sea containers and globalized finance. The original analysis about class, I think, has to be very modified by the fact that we now basically have one class per country. And then we interconnect those countries, armies between our classes. You know, the industrial proletariat are Chinese and the bourgeoisie are American. And anybody in America that isn't bourgeoisie is being seen as in some way fundamentally untrustworthy. Mm-hmm. And that's completely different from 50 years ago when America was industrial proletariat. Mm-hmm. So, you know, my primary critique of the left is that they're really still very trapped in the industrial age. And I haven't yet seen a new left ideology that correctly understands, you know, globalism around climate change, globalism around supply chains, and a fundamental grip on the post-industrial society. So, you know, it's not that there's no room for a new left-wing analysis to emerge in that space, but I think you've got to go back to international socialism and say, okay, so what does it look like to have a climate international? Mm-hmm. What does it look like to say, you know, we're going to really seriously look at both the industrial and the pre-industrial, aka the agrarian proletariats, and say, look, you know, everybody has a common unified interest in making sure the climate continues to be there, because 50% of the human race are directly dependent on that climate for the stability to bring their food. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I think that there is a huge ideological gulf where everybody's got trapped inside of the idea of socialism one country at a time, and the welfare state is the defining objective of socialism, which is a very, very, very watered down kind of Marxism. Mm-hmm. Right? I mean, the whole point of Marxism, as I always understood it, was international socialism, and you pay for the healthcare out of the now no longer needed defense budgets. Right? Swords into plowshares was a huge part of that. And all of that vision has been diluted, and nobody's really seriously talking about the relationship between Marx and environment, because it wasn't the problem in Marx's day. And much like the libertarians are completely broken on environmental issues, you know, there has to be a new generation of leadership inside of socialism to make socialism relevant for the era of climate change and runaway technology.
If I could really briefly, I know Casey probably wants to respond a little bit. Casey, anything you want to add to that? Or, I mean, I'm sure Vinay is fine if you want to push back a little.
Maybe hit me. Give me something to work with here, boys.
I mean, you're attacking my Papa Marx. I mean, I don't know what I got to say. No, it's I honestly want to listen more to your ideas, because, like, I think you're kind of right insofar that, like, Stalinism is in some ways a death cult that glorifies the destruction of gulags or people of particular nationalities. Same with Maoism. That's made most salient with Pol Pot. And we can have debates about, like, whether any of them are communists or not, but now you're getting into No True Scotsman.
Well, I mean, the bottom line is that, you know, they're certainly not what Marx had in mind when Marx sat down and wrote his stuff, but they're what happens when idiots get hold of Marx.
And like, even if you look on in his later works, like after the Paris Commune and before World War I, even when you factor in modern iterations of Marxism, like intersectional theory, Angela Davis and the like, it's there's an incompleteness there that I can't deny.
Well, I think that's especially true with issues like global climate change. It's just, as you said, Vinay, it is not something that Marx could have thought up or could have predicted. And I think we do need to update our operating systems in a lot of ways.
That's right. And, you know, this is equally true on the libertarian side, right? The libertarians are a farce when it comes to any serious discussion of environmental limit. And that's not because you can't do eco-libertarianism. I mean, I took a crack at it myself 10 years ago. But, you know, to make eco-libertarianism work, you have to do things like give the Earth a legal identity and then transfer ownership of most of the assets on Earth to the Earth. Right? And then the Earth can enforce its property rights against the human race through proxies that basically litigate against corporations on behalf of the Earth to enforce the Earth's property rights. And that's completely consistent with libertarian theory, but you're not going to see libertarians running around and demanding that the Earth has the right to litigate against corporations anytime soon. because they're just in the wrong ideological place. So, you know, I think that the left-right political machinery... So this might be useful background, right? So half of my family are Scottish working class. My grandmother was a weaver and my grandfather was a framing carpenter. And, you know, so I grew up with the kind of ambient Scottish socialism and a very, you know, very ordinary working class identity. And in the 1980s in Scotland, they hadn't invented racism yet, right? Like, it just never occurred to anybody that race was a factor because there were so few people around from other races or cultures that it was seen as, like, you know, just a personal oddity. Like, are you Indian, Vinay? Yes. Do you eat curry? Yes. Okay, what are we going to do next week then? And, you know, it was just, it was almost unique, right? That it was a region that was entirely white and had never thought of racism as a thing. It was super wacky. So for me, the struggle of the working class is very much my story, right? I came out of that kind of poverty. I got a bunch of intellectual stuff from my father, who's an Indian doctor, but really grew up in working class Scotland after my parents split. And everything that I've managed to claw out of society has come from the position of being, you know, Scottish working class, half caste. And, you know, that was a lot of what took me to America, was just getting away from class war in the wars that I couldn't win because I had three or four different things that were against me, also dyslexic. So, you know, in that respect, I have a very strong sympathy for socialism. But what I really want to know is why have the bastards completely failed to deliver? You know, like, come on, there should have been an aggressive expansion of the rights of workers as we got more and more and more new technology. And instead we got trapped inside of the union structures. The unions became corrupt. The whole thing imploded. We've totally failed to learn from Scandinavia. You know, so I feel like, you know, socialism has not delivered on much of its promise at the same time as capitalism has super over-delivered. You know, and this is, you know, like all of this has to be faced.
What do you mean by over-delivered? In just in terms of production, or do you mean social? Like, what could you elaborate?
So, the broad promise of capitalism, right? Let's talk about the broad promise of socialism. So, the broad promise of socialism is a fair day's work will get you a fair day's pay, and nobody will be left behind if they're unable to work. Broadly speaking, that's what the Scandinavians implemented. Broadly speaking, that's the working man's common understanding of socialism, is everybody's a job, everybody works, and if you can't get a job, somebody will take care of you, and if you get ill, somebody will take care of you too. And that's, you know, that's not an intellectual's understanding of socialism, but it's the basic offer that was made to the working man. The basic offer that was made to the working man by capitalism was your standard of living will go up and up and up and up and up, because we, the ruthless sociopathic bastards that run society, are so good at allocating capital that if you just let us make all the decisions, we will breed money like flies. Right? And they've done it, right? You know, they said that they were going to produce enormous amounts of wealth. They produced enormous amounts of wealth. They said they produced technological innovation. They did that too. And they've largely delivered all the stuff that they said that they were going to deliver, while at the same time also manifesting every single failing that Marx said that they would manifest. Mm-hmm. So we're sort of in a position where I feel like the capitalists shipped for good and for ill, and socialism hasn't really shipped except in the Scandinavian model, which everybody looks at and nobody seems to want to learn from. And also I should mention Kerala, which is like democratically elected matriarchal market communism, dollar day of incomes, I'm going to say 76, 78 year life expectancy, 95% literacy, demographics are right in line with Europe on a dollar a day. And yeah, it really shows you what you can get done with communism if you actually put your mind to it. So I guess what I'm trying to frame is this, right? If there is going to be another round of movement towards, let's say, broad socialism, not necessarily Marxist socialism, but broad socialism, communitarianism, communalism, people taking care of each other, whatever you want to frame that as, we have to get less stupid about it. Because, God damn it, it's busted and we're very bad at learning.
Well, I was just going to add to that. I think something that gets left out of the discussions about the Scandinavian model is that there's a cultural component to a lot of that. People often don't reference it, but in a lot of Scandinavian countries, there's this idea of Jante's Law, which is, you know, you are not above the society you're in, and you better not think that you're above us. You're not special. You're part of a community. And I think that's why that model works in Scandinavia in a lot of ways. Whereas in America, I think a lot of people almost consider that dystopian, like, oh no, the individual has to come above all else.
Mm. Yeah, I mean, the Jante Law stuff, certainly the Scandinavians experience it as being very oppressive. Mm-hmm. You know, I did a workshop in Scandinavia for an outfit called the Chaos Pilots. Mm-hmm. And one of the things that I teach is a set of kind of traditional, whatever they are. Anyway, one of the things that I teach is a set of methods from the kind of meditation that I do, which look a lot like method acting or improv theater, right? They're taking on of roles as a way of expanding your sense of who you are and what your possibilities are. And one of the best ways of getting people to really see themselves in a new light is to have them show up as rock stars. Because mm-hmm. everybody's got a nice clear archetype of what it is to be a rock star or an actor or something like that. You know, money, power, wealth, charisma, fabulousness, the story is about you. You know, you get what you want, but not because you're an ass, just because it's natural that you do. And most people can find enough of that stuff lying around in their head that if you have a room of people that act as if that's who they are for a little while, they can put that skin on and get to run around inside of it, which is often a heck of an awakening for people like, oh, wow, okay, so really being a celebrity is about how other people treat you. It's not that you change, it's just that people treat you differently. And that's quite an empowering thing for a lot of people. When I ran that stuff in Scandinavia, they freaked out. Right, I practically got burned at the stake for suggesting that there was anything good about being a star or suggesting that any of the ways that you felt when you were in that role could be learned from. People found it catastrophically personally threatening to think of themselves as standing out from a crowd in any way at all. Mm-hmm. And at that point, I really began to realize, like, well, you guys are really paying a toll here.
Mm-hmm. I guess... Yeah. I was going to say, I guess in that regard, well, I think we can look at the good and bad of something like Jante's Law. I do think we can go in the opposite direction of, you know, the individual is the only thing that matters. But I think you're right, too. There's a flip side to that coin where it can become very, very oppressive. I guess this sort of gets into one of your main areas of interest. You were mentioning the thing about rock stars. I guess where your focus differs than, you know, a great portion of the left is you're not so much focused on, I hate the 1%, but you are against poverty. You're interested more in the eradication of poverty than going against the 1% is how I understand it.
Yeah. I mean, so let's talk very specifically about inequality, right? Mm-hmm. So I think the dumbest thing that the left has ever done, which is really saying something, is they stood directly on a cultural landmine when they said that they were about reducing inequality. Because if there's one thing that Americans love, it's stars, right? They love the idea that one person is just phenomenally good at something and that's why they're rich and famous. They love the idea of merit, self-made men, self-made women, all the rest of that stuff. They love that stuff. And it's super deeply baked in at a cultural level. So what I'm, you know, fundamentally interested in is the living conditions of the worse off 0.5% of your society. Mm-hmm. Right? You know, if you take something like a refugee camp, if the worst off 0.5% of the people in the refugee camp have enough to eat and have adequate medical care, the rest of the camp has no problems. Mm-hmm. Right? If the worst off Americans, you know, had a, you know, 9x12 room that they had the only key to, and they had power, sanitation, heating, and food. Mm-hmm. At that point, do we really care? You know, so everybody's got something to eat, everybody's got basic health care. Past that, do I care if you know, basketballers were making enough money to buy a Porsche every 3 months. To be honest, I don't really care, right? Like, the level at which politics is an absolute priority for me is the level at which we are stepping over homeless people to go into, like, the local corner store. Mm-hmm. You know, and the homeless people have been creeping further and further and further, you know, into the development that I live on, mm-hmm. right? The homeless people have gotten closer and closer and closer to the door. And, you know, you're getting to that point of like, wow, I'm practically at the point of having to step over homeless people to go in and get, you know, a can of soup. Okay, then, right? This is a problem. So if socialism, I don't want to say socialism exactly, if our kind of humanitarian politic was we're going to make sure that the worst off people in society have a decent quality of life, at that point, I kind of feel like the middle class can stand on its own goddamn feet in their fight against the rich. Mm-hmm. Right? I feel like the working class have a fight against the rich and the middle class, and they're more than capable of taking on that fight and organizing themselves to fight that fight and win that fight. The people that have no capability to do it themselves, the really poor, the really broken, the mentally ill, the alcoholic, all of that set, you know, people with learning disabilities, that kind of worst off 0.5% are the people that I feel like almost all of our political will should be focused on. Because if those people are adequately taken care of, everybody else will muddle through. But what I see a lot of is enormous focus on, you know, stuff like microaggressions. My God, if all the energy that had gone into fighting about microaggressions had gone into actually fighting homelessness, we'd have gotten something done. Mm-hmm. But homelessness was other people, whereas microaggressions was me. You see what I'm saying?
No, yeah, yeah.
So I really feel like the kind of crux of this is, you know, my politics are very much the politics of the losers, right? Mm-hmm. How do we deal with the people that lost? How do we take care of the people that lost? How do we manage the fact that most people will lose at some point in their lives?
That reminds me of, you know, I've taken some courses in sociology, and my one professor was talking about this whole idea of like a guns and butter model where, you know, we don't need to necessarily have a system where when someone loses, they're completely destroyed. We can have a system where, you know, someone may lose, but they don't have to be decimated in the process.
Yeah, absolutely, right? And the notion that you could establish a minimum standard of living to which everybody is entitled, I think is pretty doable as long as that minimum is suitably low, mm-hmm. right? So if you imagine, just as a thought experiment, right? So imagine that in every population center of more than a few thousand people, it is necessary by law for there to be at least one empty bedroom where anybody could go for any reason and sleep the night and be fed, you know, 2,500 calories if they want it. Right? So how many problems in society does that solve, right? Mm-hmm. Well, it gets rid of homelessness because at that point, you know, that homelessness is optional. Every time a homeless person walks into that room, another room is opened up, and then the next homeless person could go into that one. You know, the need for things like women's shelters, if somebody is being violent, you just walk out and there's a bed for you somewhere else. You are safe. You have room to yourself. Kids that are having problems with their parents, you just walk out the front door. Old people that have nowhere to go because their pensions have imploded, they just walk out, leave the keys, you know, move. So the fact that so many of our social problems are soluble by provision of a 9x12 room with a bed and three meals, that shouldn't cost very much to provide. I mean, we're talking like, what, $25 a day or something? Mm-hmm. You know, the state has the ability to eminent domain land. It's got plenty of land that it already owns. You build things that look like cheap hotels or motels on those. You make sure that they're pretty small so they're efficient to run. You provide some very, very low-level basic social services, and about 25 different social problems all evaporate because now you have a place to live. Mm-hmm. So think of the, you know, endless fractal complexity of social policy and thinking about how we do, you know, benefits and welfare systems and basic income and la, 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 la. Endless complexity, the wrangling about inequality and all the rest of that. And I think actually, if you really boil it right down, as long as there is a place to sleep and something to eat, past that, I don't really care. Mm-hmm. Once we've gotten a place to sleep and something to eat for 100% of human beings in your country, then we can ask what the next priority is. Mm-hmm. But I don't really give a fuck or have any respect for people that are obsessing about their struggle from the working class to the middle class, and the middle class to the upper middle class, and the upper middle class to the rich, or whatever it happens to be. Like, really? You're going to make that the center of our dialogue before we've done something about the homeless people? Are you really sure that you're the priority in this story? And I think the answer for the vast majority of those cases is no, these people are not the priority. They're just making themselves the priority.
Well, I mean, even, as much as I have an interest in someone like Marx, Marx and a lot of Marxists generally don't have a lot of sympathy for the lumpen or the poor. And it's actually, since you're bringing this all up, it is hard to argue with you on this point that even within the left, a lot of people are getting left behind.
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, I've seen, and you know, let me just stand right on the landmine here and let's all hear it click, right? I've seen the amount of energy that was invested in the trans wars at the same time as American women lost abortion rights. Mm-hmm. Right? Tell me that that was a wise investment of cultural power to fight for liberation and inclusion for a very tiny minority of people at the same time as 50% of people lost access to abortion over maybe a third or half of America. Right? Like, we really, really, really prioritize the needs of the few above the needs of the many in the investment of cultural power in feminism in the past, say, 10 years. And I think that the consequences of that decision will be felt for generations. Right? How did you come to the conclusion that that was our priority?
I guess the only thing I would say that the trans issue is sort of important to me just because I know people who are, well, I live in Pittsburgh, and Pennsylvania can be very culturally reactionary a lot of ways. So I've known trans people that are very, they're in a vulnerable position because of living here. I think you can have the best of both worlds, maybe in looking out for women and abortion rights, and also looking out for the rights of trans people. But I don't think
what we did, right? What we did was the great battlefront in feminism in the past 10 years was the trans wars. That was where the attention went. It's where the energy went. It's where the rage capital was expended, right? And while that fight was happening, right? And let's be clear, that was a big fight and a lot of energy was invested in that thing. While that was happening, abortion got rolled back, right? So we didn't do both and, right? We left an enormous number of women totally fucked on a basic human right, right? At the same time as we built a whole bunch of new rights for people that in a lot of cultures wouldn't even be recognized as women. So we're in a very, very tricky position here because, you know, we have a limited amount of political power, and if we're spending it on elites rather than on the main base case, we have a problem. And I want to stress here that the vast majority of the trans folks that I know divide into one or two categories. They're either economic elites with a bunch of money to burn on elective surgery and hormone treatments and other elective medical procedures, right? Or they're dirt broke and very close to mentally ill because they can't get proper care, right? So, you know, I think we have to basically look at this and say, is this emblematic of other structural errors that the left has made over time? Have we tended to side with the few and ignore the fights of the many? And I would suggest we've seen exactly the same thing around things like the death of the labor union as a cultural institution. The labor union was a thing that very effectively fought for the many, and the labor unions have been totally marginalized inside of modern leftist thought at the same time as we've gotten really, really fussy about fucking identity politics and all of this stuff that we call intersectionality.
I just wanted to add real quick. I wanted to say, I appreciate what you said about how there seems to be a divide with people in the trans community, because I have known people that are, you know, very economically advantaged on one side of that, and I've known people that just can't get the proper care, and I do feel like that side of it has been, they've been ignored.
That's right, and there's not much in the middle, right? I mean, it seems to be a really bipolar thing, right? You know, generally speaking, the trans people that I meet are either wealthy or poor. Hardly ever meet one that's basically middle class. Mm-hmm. So the crux of this, right, is this tendency to fight for the needs of the few rather than the needs of the many. Mm-hmm. So intersectionality pretty much replaced all dialogue about things like labor unions, right? The vast majority of the firepower on the left is spent on cultural issues, not on money. But the vast majority of the suffering caused by capitalism is financial rather than cultural, right? It's minimum wage legislation and universal healthcare that will really change people's lives in the direction that the left is meant to be pushing on. Whereas I don't think that more intersectional theory is going to improve anybody's life in any kind of meaningful way anytime soon, because we went around that roadshow way back in the days of identity politics. And, you know, frankly, it's the same errors that identity politics was built on, which is it's a leftism based on ever smaller groups rather than a leftism which is based on genuine global solidarity. Mm-hmm. You see what I'm saying? And this is what I mean about the capitalists have shipped and the left hasn't, right? The capitalists shipped their vision of unbridled prosperity. Mm-hmm. Right? Oh, yeah, you want to see some unbridled prosperity? Yeah, look at China. How's that for unbridled prosperity? At the same time as the left has failed to ship social solidarity, because the ideological methods that the left has shipped are methods which do not produce social solidarity. The illusion that intersectionality correctly applied will eventually result in the emergence of large movements again, it's a total pipe dream. That's just not what intersectionality does. So, you know, abortion rights, minimum wage, universal health care, that bedrock tripod receives practically no attention from the modern left. And it's a total abdication of responsibility. Anybody that says they're off the left, those things should be absolutely primal, and the labor union as an institution has to be reclaimed.
I want to give Casey a chance to respond, and then I really want to shift gears into the issue of the current pandemic. But Casey, go ahead.
Yeah, I would push back against the notion that intersectionality has baked within it a sense of divisiveness, only insofar that that's I think a consequence of post-structuralist intersectionality. This idea that your identity as a person is the fundamental atomized notion of you, instead of just one aspect of a vast array of Venn diagrams that overlap with each other at certain periods of times in your life, and blah 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 blah. And when we say the left in America, it's already a uniquely centrist beast by and large.
so true.
You know, I would say the international left in America, the very small portion of people that subscribe to those kind of beliefs, they not that I can be a spokesperson for them, I'm not, but they generally do understand that the financial aspects, the broad-based mass appeal of repealing onerous right-to-work laws or raising the minimum wage or providing universal health care, these are the issues that raise communities of all identities. But you're right that the left infrastructure in America, the Democrats and those slightly to the left of them, the progressive liberals, I guess.
Yeah. Yep.
Not that I want to be casting shade on people that are at least tactical allies, but that they definitely have helped further this sense of divisiveness and have been movement breaking. And I agree with you in that. I agree with you in that respect. That most self-avowed leftists in America don't embrace this notion of international solidarity. And I completely agree with you. That is a core aspect of leftism and something that's been abandoned in the American left for as long as there's been an American left. And that's something that needs to be fought against, that this notion that we are one global community needs to be embraced. Mm-hmm. And it's when you approach issues of systemic racism and sexism and classism through that lens that meaningful inroads can be made, or at least creative ones that we haven't seen expressed yet.
Certainly a place where you could get everybody on the same page pretty quickly.
Yeah.
You know?
Most people agree bombing a fucking, using the U.S. military to bomb a school bus full of kids is generally poor form. They just, you know, don't know what to do about it.
And it's the failure to form the links, right? The ability to say that, look, the tendency of American police officers to shoot black teenagers waving cell phones is directly linked to the tendency of the U.S. military to carpet bomb civilian targets, but drone bomb civilian targets, right? You know, that's the same machinery, right? They've gone out there with a pre-arranged model of what they think the threat is. They've come to the conclusion that it's okay to kill the people who fit that demographic. It doesn't fit particularly well for the actual reality, which is why they keep bombing weddings and shooting teenagers with phones. And it's the same problem, right? And that inability to see that that's the same problem, like why is the state killing colored people casually on really, 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 really shoddy evidence and risk assessment? Wow, that's the same problem. Hey, you know that thing where we keep like frying people in the electric chair, but they're mostly black and then a whole bunch of them turn out to be innocent later on? Yeah, well, that's the same problem again. Wow, it is almost like we don't really bother checking whether brown people and black people are actually guilty before we kill them. Ooh. And, you know, like, it's if you zoom back a little, it's really easy to see that there's a unity of cause there, right? But all the people that are chipping away at different parts of that particular wall are chipping away at different parts of that wall, right? Like, oh. And if there was ever any power in the left, you know, with all my doubts about Marx and all the rest of that, right? But if there was ever any power in the left, it was from getting everybody to acknowledge that their problems were facets of an underlying set of problems, right? And I mean, for me, you know, socialism in Scotland was a very different creature from socialism in a lot of other places because it had a lot to do with education, it had a lot to do with libraries, it had a lot to do with structural damage left over from an event called the Highland Clearances, where my ancestors' land was stolen and then replaced with sheep farming by rich bastards. And, you know, we had, I don't know, maybe 300 years since the family lost the land in Ayrshire, and they had been bitter, enraged landless peasantry ever since. And what the left represented was access to capital by virtue of social solidarity. We will share a library and we will get educated. We will share a union and we'll use that to basically browbeat the bosses into paying us properly. And that sort of, you know, tribalist left really died in America with the labor unions as respectable institutions. You don't see the left as like, right, we are all in this together and fuck those people. And if that's not what the left is it, you know, what's left? Right?
A bunch it's of constant infighting. The Judean People's Front and what's that Monty Python skit, you know?
Yeah, that's right, right? The people's, you know, united front of Judea and all the rest of it. The other thing is that the left has had some enormous victories that it won't claim, right? So the free software movement was an enormous liberatory act, right? 100% what a 21st century communism ought to look like, free software. And everybody pisses on Richard Stallman because he's autistic and a little strange. Right? I mean, Solomon's strangeness is not limited to autism, right? But, you know, like, you know, $100 billion or maybe at this point $250 billion of intellectual property assets made available for any human being for any purpose at any time, and nobody holds that up as being an enormous triumph of socialism? Mm-hmm. Any child on earth can get a copy of Wikipedia downloaded onto their phone, right? Either a page at a time or their phones could ship with the entire thing as a standard feature, right? The, you know, hundreds of thousands of hours of openly licensed material, the operating systems, you know, the Mac and Android, all built on free software, Linux in its many incarnations, GNU Linux, thank you, Richard. You know, that enormous transfer of wealth into the commons, completely unlauded and unheralded as a political step. Stallman has been fighting out there alone for decades while people basically nipped at his heels and totally ignored his victories. And, you know, this is why I've developed such an enormous acidic hatred of the left, is they won't do their fucking jobs and they won't support their heroes. And if they won't do their fucking jobs on things like abortion and they won't support their heroes when you get somebody like Stallman, what the fuck use are they? Right? And, you know, really, 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 you know, there is a primal Scottish allegiance to the left in principle. But in practice, I don't see anybody I could support at all. I mean, other than Corbyn, I have a lot of respect and fondness for Corbyn.
I like Corbyn a lot.
I met him once.
Really?
Yep, I met him once. He was standing in the rain outside of a restaurant And one of my mates pointed out and said, hey, that's Jeremy Corbyn. And I think, I'm not even sure he was Labour Party leader at that point, but he was certainly pretty well known. I think he might have just become leader pretty recently. So I went outside and I lent him a hat. And then he came inside and had a chat with us, and it was me with a couple of futurist mates. And he was extraordinarily knowledgeable, and he took like 20 minutes just talking with a bunch of random strangers that lent him a hat because he was genuinely interested in futurism. Great. But the policies that he was espousing didn't stand a rat's arse in hell of actually ever working. Very strong intellectually, had the values, couldn't get the policy machinery in place. You know, if Corbyn had been like, look, what we're going to do is we're going to sort out this basic income thing once and for all, and we're going to figure out how to build enough housing that house pricing comes down to be in the maximum of 20% of income, and if house prices rise above that level, we'll simply open up permitting and build more houses. Boom, landslide victory, off you go, right, you're in power, mate. But instead, you know, the unwillingness to say, look, food, shelter, education, healthcare, working conditions, abortion rights, and a slightly wider set of women's rights, maybe do something about childcare, just nail it down to the basics, right? Because, you know, from my perspective, everything to do with intersectionality can fuck off. Everything to do with identity politics can fuck off. It's never produced the increase in well-being for the working people that the left was meant to produce. It's a very, very middle class, very, very intellectuals whining about their tenure kind of mode. And, you know, like, I've been there. I grew up in absolute goddamn poverty in rural Scotland. I've seen the problems that the left is meant to fix unfixed for generations. I just don't know what the hell they're smoking.
When you say, though, so you say identity politics, intersectionality can, you know, from your perspective, fuck off. So
yes.
But does that mean we have to throw, you know, LGBT under the bus? Does it mean we have to throw anti-racism under the bus? Because I don't get that. I don't get the impression you're saying that either.
No, not at all. Intersectionality and identity politics as methods are fucked, right? And I say this because every time those concepts are brought into a working social scene, the working social scene stops working, right? It's a bit like postmodernism, where postmodernism is an astonishingly effective way of dismantling old social structures, but it gives you no tools for building new social structures. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, I'm obviously, right, half Scottish, half Indian. I have very strong identities on both sides. I ought to be a poster child for intersectionality in that I've got both oppression on the basis of being Scottish working class and oppression on the basis of being brown and oppression on the basis of being neither brown nor white, right? I got a great set of cards if we're going to play identity politics games. Like, man, I can play entitled in all kinds of ways and I'm disabled, right? So the bottom line is that, you know, if we teach people to use their weakness as weapons, we teach them to ignore their strength as a weapon. Mm-hmm. When I got into fights with the Nazis when they tried to, you know, colonize Ethereum, make a bunch of money, and then use it to build Nazi communications infrastructure, right? You know, there was a big push to get, you know, the far right onto the blockchain as a way of providing them with uncensorable communications. And I fought that. And I fought that with the credible threat of we will fuck you up if you try it. Mm-hmm. Right? So when we talk about LGBT rights, you know, I think the Pink Pistols had a lot to be said for them. Right? I think the bedrock of, you know, feminist lawyers, many of whom were lesbians, that litigated the hell out of the American government every time it put a foot out of line for decades, these people were super effective. Right? If you try and gay bash us, we will shoot you in the face, motherfucker. This is good. Right? If you try and strip out the protections that we have in the Constitution because you're a bunch of Republican arseholes, we'll sue your arses off. This was good. Right? And when we sort of begin to say, look, I am weak and therefore I have entitlements, what we're doing is we're making it very, very easy for our enemies to simply continue to kick us. Because if you tell your enemies that you're weak, kicking you is what they do. So what we've done is we've taken away the scariness of the left and replaced it with an extraordinarily refined set of structural games around whining. Right? And this is not to say that people's grievances are not real and that people's problems are not there, right? But what makes me an effective actor is not my mastery of the language of intersectionality and my pleading for special treatment. It's my ability to punch people in the neck, either physically or intellectually, if they get up my nose. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I think that what we've done here is we've totally defanged the left mm-hmm. by using a rhetorical technique that only works against the left. The enemies are on the right. The enemies are in the center. Intersectionality doesn't work against racists. Intersectionality only works against mildly careless, ordinary people. You see what I'm saying? Like, it's just a toolkit. It's a great weapon for getting power inside of a bunch of people that all agree already. It's a horrible weapon for taking power from the people that would like to see you all shoved into ovens. You know, we forgot who the enemy was. And this is why I've always said that identity politics was given to the left by the CIA.
You know, it's interesting. We were initially going to do more of a discussion of your work on pandemics, but I think in a way, the direction we went in some ways has been more interesting. And I think it'll be challenging for people, which is something I've always wanted for this show. Well, it's called Parallax Views for a reason, folks. I want it differently.
And, you know, let us feed all the people. Let us ensure we've got universal healthcare and all the rest of that. But God damn it, like, you know, what worked for my ancestors in Scotland as they went from being treated very much like the people in Ireland or Cuba had been treated to having actual respect and actual jobs and actual power was the ability to do large-scale social solidarity in a way that's very Scandinavian, right? Now, I don't know anything about how this kind of stuff works in Scandinavia, but I will guarantee, right, and I'm going to arm wave a little on this, that the vast majority of their progress was made in the era of large-scale social solidarity, right? And the issues that are afflicting America right now are large-scale social solidarity issues. Mm-hmm. So I think that it is worth considering that we might want to go back to a fully effective toolkit from previous eras to fight the previous era's wars all over again. Mm-hmm. You know, where are we going to get the healthcare? Who's going to take care of the kids? Why are our schools shit? These problems don't require a very highly intellectual, subtle, intersectional toolkit. You can solve them with, in you know, ideological like sledgehammers.
Mm-hmm. Well, I do think the left has to get a lot meaner about things if it wants to win. I will definitely agree with that. Before
but
you
it's
go,
it's got to get meaner about the right things, right? It's got to get meaner about the right things because the choice of targets is the core of political activism. What are we fighting for and what are we fighting against?
Before you go, if you just have a few minutes here, just briefly, your thoughts on coronavirus and the current pandemic. And maybe, I think in a lot of ways it relates to all of this stuff. We were talking on Facebook, you and I, about, you know, this. There's a class war element to all of this.
There certainly is. So I did a whole podcast about this, which if people are interested in the class war coronavirus thing, it is for an outfit called Fringe Thinkers. Fringe mm-hmm. Thought, I guess you put a link in the show notes. Mm-hmm. It's on materium.com/CSR as a link to it. So the bottom line is that we now have, I think, five social classes, right? And that's the people that can work from home, the people that have to go to work, medical staff, people that have pre-existing illnesses where if they get coronavirus, they're very likely to die, and people that have had it and recovered and are now likely to be immune, right? And then you've got, you know, all the other class structure stuff is still there. But the bottom line is that our security is entirely dependent on the welfare and the well-being of the people that are working in the stores and doing the food deliveries. And if the people working in the stores are just like, this is too dangerous, I'm going home, sorry, the whole thing breaks, right? The medical staff have gotten royally fucked. My God, I've never seen a group of people get fucked systemically as hard as people that work in hospitals during this coronavirus thing. You know, the hospitals don't have proper protective equipment, the patients are dying in the freaking corridors, the president is on television telling people that this is all going to blow over and it's not really a particular problem. and, you know, just wait for this untested drug to give us, you know, some kind of hope that it will all blow over. So, you know, why is this happening, right? I mean, Naomi Klein and that gang have been all over it, like, oh, look, it's disaster capitalism. Look, it's a shock doctrine again. But, you know, really, and, you know, there's truth in those arguments. I'm not saying that's nonsense. But the fundamental driver here is the rights of workers to have proper protective equipment for the jobs that they're in, mm-hmm. is the kind of things that unions used to be really great at enforcing. Mm-hmm. Right? And now we've got all of these workers, some of whom are highly skilled and some of whom are not, all in the same boat, that they're being sent to die because they're is that not the very core struggle?
You broke up inside there for a second. You said you cut off at because I think you were saying
right. So this core struggle of all these workers are being sent to do their jobs without proper protective equipment, right, is exactly one of the core struggles of old style unionism. Mm-hmm. You will provide us with a safe and healthy workplace, or we won't turn up to work. We will strike until we are given proper safeguards in our work environment. Right? So that is a problem that should have been solved by medical unions. It should have been solved by unions for people that had retail jobs. And the inability of these people to force their bosses to give them proper protective equipment is because they didn't have the kind of collective bargaining power that was necessary to say, look, you're going to do this, or our union is going to sue your hospital and we're going to wind up owning the hospital ourselves, because after this is done, the settlements will number in the hundreds of millions of dollars. Billions of dollars. Imagine the lawsuits that will come out from all the medical personnel that went to work without proper protective equipment, caught coronavirus and died. By the time this is done, those people's families should wind up owning the hospitals that those people died in. And, you know, the inability to relate to that as being a critical issue in labor rights is because nobody in America even talks about labor rights anymore as an issue of the left. You see what I'm saying? Mm-hmm. And what is a left that doesn't talk about labor?
Real quick, too, I wanted to ask. I think we talk a lot about the virus, the coronavirus, COVID-19, but I've been seeing people, you know, this is very contagious and it's very dangerous. The people saying, oh, this is just the same as the flu, they're completely wrong in my view. At the same time, I think we have to remember, you know, there's a lack of ventilators. There's a lack of medical supplies. And we have to ask, well, how did that happen? Because I think that will contribute to the death toll. The lack.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah. And maybe I'm curious what you think we should do about that.
Well, okay, so let's talk a wee bit about the characteristics of the virus, right? There are really two numbers that are important for understanding kind of new pandemic-y, risky type things. One number is a thing called the R, which is how infectious is it, and the other number is called the CFR, which is how many people that get the virus will die. And then there are a whole bunch of other subsidiary numbers like hospitalization rates and so on. But the bottom line is that your first question is, what's the R and what's the CFR? So the R for coronavirus is somewhere over 3. I've seen 3.8 as a pretty reasonable estimate. And to give you some context, polio had an R of something like 6. And polio was so infectious that if somebody sneezed in a swimming pool, everybody in the pool would die, right? I mean, it was just unbelievably infectious. Seasonal influenza has an R of about 1.4. So we're dealing with something which is astonishingly infectious even compared to the flu, and heading into the same kind of massively contagious nature of things like polio. So it's a really infectious bug. Then the question of how many people does it kill? Best guess I've seen is 1.5% of the population, massively weighted towards the old. So you would expect probably, and I'm going to guess here, 2/3 or 3/4 of the casualties to be over 65, and probably half to be over 80, over 70, maybe 75. Anyway, heavily weighted towards the old. So for young people, it's probably about as dangerous as a seasonal flu. right? If the young people are in good physical health, if they've got any kind of pre-existing condition, cancers, kidney issues, heart issues, it seems to kill even young people with pre-existing conditions very aggressively.
I want to note real quick, and I don't know if you would agree with this, but I've had some people say to me, if they have, I've known people that maybe struggle with obesity, and they'll say, oh, I'm already dead. There's no way that I could survive coronavirus. I don't think that's necessarily true either. There's multiple factors at work. It's not, you can have a pre-existing condition and survive. I mean, I have family that works at hospitals. There's been cases like that. It's just a matter of your risk and your vulnerability goes up.
Yes. And I mean, the vulnerability, 20%, right? 25% seems to be the worst case you get. You know, I mean, exactly. So, yeah, I mean, even your worst cases, even with no care, people over 80 will survive well over 50% of the time. I would say more like 70 or 80% of the time. And that's the over 80s, mm-hmm. right? So, you know, we're dealing with something where it's actually pretty hard to die of this thing relative to the other things which have caused us problems in the past, right? I mean, smallpox is ballpark 30% fatal. COVID, worst case, is 20%. And for non-compromised populations, it's definitely under 2%. It's probably under 1%. Right? So this thing, much as it's pretty scary, is barely a pandemic. It's at the extreme lower end of things that should cause general public freakout. If this had been one of the other flu-like organisms that we were worried about in the past 10 or 20 years, bird flu was more than 50% fatal. Mm-hmm. In normal, healthy adults, bird flu was more than 50% fatal. Can you imagine if that was had gotten loose? You know, like, what's the remaining living population of New York? We think we've got about 6 million left, maybe 7. Okay, and what do you reckon it'll be by the end of next week or the week after that? Well, we're hoping for 4.5, right? Like, it's just not that kind of problem, right? The death tolls are still, you know, well below what you would expect of, you know, things like heart disease, right? I mean, to give you context, smoking kills about 500,000 Americans a year, and there is a small but realistic chance that COVID will kill less people this year than smoking did. Mm-hmm. So it's a bad scene, but, you know, we put up with a lot worse. Mm-hmm. If, on the other hand, we lose infection control and the thing really hits us full hard, it will kill probably between 5 and 10 million Americans.
Wow.
Well, I mean, because remember, America has an enormous number of old people and a really, really crappy healthcare system. So you take an awful lot of old people and a crappy healthcare system, you put them together, an enormous number of people die because they're old, and an enormous number of more people die because the healthcare system is crappy. So, you know, if we wind up with full, uncontrolled, rampant infection, social distancing breaks down, you know, and you wind up with just, you know, comprehensively ineffective response, the doctors all quit their jobs in the hospitals because the hospitals are collapsing and they don't have any protective equipment. They just walk out of the wards, which is unthinkable right now, but give it a year, 6 months. You know, it's not now that you're going to get the big problems. If we haven't gotten this thing fully under control by winter, oh my God. Mm-hmm. Right? Because winter is like freeze to death in, what, a third of America? Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, pretty much all the way through the Midwest, all the way through the Northeast, winter will kill you very, very quickly. Mm-hmm. And imagine a situation where you've got uncontrolled COVID running amok in the middle of winter, in the middle of an economic crash. So, you know, it's not that there aren't really serious horror scenarios on the table. Mm-hmm. It's just that to get into those horror scenarios, you have to demonstrate pervasive, multi-tier social, political, and medical incompetence. And I don't think we're going to wind up there, right? I think we're going to wind up sorting out the governance stuff pretty quickly in the next month or so. And then after that, I think we'll play a much more rational game and it'll all be fine. I mean, be fine. A lot of people will still die, but not millions unnecessarily.
Do you think in that regard that there's any way to solve these problems like the ventilator problem? And also, you mentioned the crappy healthcare system. I think a lot more people are going to die because of that crappy healthcare system. Do you think there's any hope of that changing in the future?
Well, okay. So at this point, we've got, 0% interest rates and unlimited quantitative easing to try and keep the economy going, and unemployment is going to be pushing, 30%? Mm-hmm. So the death of capitalism that started in 2008, I would say, is now fully matured, right? Mm-hmm. The system was incredibly fragile. They propped it up and kept going and propped it up and kept going and propped it up and kept going. It couldn't survive another shock. We've had the other shock. So I think that at this point, Mammon itself has COVID, right? Capitalism is dying of this disease in the same way that individuals are dying of this disease, because the system had become so incredibly fragile and tenuous and strung out that when we had a large-scale pervasive system shock, the damn thing has corpsed. So let me very briefly talk about how I used to work a lot on failed states. And the US military didn't really understand that when you try to perform a regime change in a place like Iraq, one of the things that could happen is that the state could die, right? It's like you're attempting to perform a brain transplant on Saddam Hussein's regime, but while Saddam Hussein's regime is on the table and you're doing the brain transplant, the patient dies on the table, because what died in Iraq was basically government as a concept. Right, what you were left with was a bunch of things that had formally comprised the government, plus a whole bunch of warlords in a new configuration, but it was no longer really a nation state. Similarly, I think that what we're seeing in America is patient died on the table for capitalism. Right, I don't think there's any way that America is going to go back to 90s model capitalism, because it's had like its fourth shock. Right, there was 9/11, then there was the dot-com crunch, then there was the 2008 collapse. Now we've got the COVID bust. And, you know, the underlying real economy has not picked up in that period. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I think that, y'all on the left really better get ready for catching this thing, because if we don't see sensible looking policy in the general vein of the New Deal or something equivalent, they're not going to be able to restart the economy. And, you know, nobody wants to see a kind of 1929-style economic wipeout in America, but note that they closed the New York Stock Exchange for only the second time in history, right as the COVID thing kicked off. So I think we are really close to approaching smoke and we've forgotten, where, you know, all options are on the table and there will be nothing but risk very, very quickly. Now, you know, maybe they'll pull off some kind of miracle and they'll figure out how to do quantitative easing and they'll gradually refloat it and they'll do 6 months or a year of basic income just to get the economy started and it will hold. But given that you had 40 million people on food stamps before this thing went down, you know, what are you going to have? 70 or 80 or 120 million on food stamps afterwards?
Well, not at that point. I was just going to say, not only that, but I think this is going to be the first of future pandemics. Because of due to ecological crisis, is my understanding.
Yeah, I mean, predicting future pandemics is hard, right? I mean, we've seen this one. There will be a bunch of structural changes that come out of this one. Those make future pandemics less likely. Mm-hmm. On the other hand, you've also got enormous numbers of poor people wading into the jungles to try and find something to eat. Makes them more likely. Overcrowding, you know, I mean, it's... prediction is difficult, especially of the future. But the systemic problems, like other pandemic diseases, right? So tuberculosis in its drug-resistant forms is all over the goddamn shop. HIV infection rates are through the roof because of methamphetamine use. Mm-hmm. I mean, I don't know whether you've tracked that story or not, but the whole meth-AIDS confluence is unbelievably bad news.
That doesn't surprise me. I'm slightly aware of it.
I mean, you know, I don't have the stats in my head to the point where I'm going to put them to the record by opening my mouth on this, but my recollection is that HIV infection rates have gone back up to, you know, levels that are genuinely alarming, largely because of meth. You know, in much the same way that heroin was a big driver for AIDS back in the day. So, you know, we've got a real problem here, which is, we've already got multiple ongoing pandemics in America at a very kind of low grade level because we have dismantled effective public health. Like drug resistant TB, you know, there's so much more that could have been done about that. HIV, there is so much more that could have been done about that. So, you know, you just can't run American society you know, as if it was still the 1970s. I've got a book called The Enemy, which is published in 1970. It's what Americans ought to know about imperialism. And it points out that America at that point was basically 2/3 of the global economy was America. And that was in 1970. 2/3 of the manufactured goods, 2/3 of the trucks, 2/3 of the airplanes, right across the chart. You know, America had basically 2/3 or more of damn near everything which had been manufactured, and it was producing 70% of the world's goods with 5% of the population. They were incredibly rich and incredibly successful. And America hasn't had anything like that kind of economic advantage literally for 50 years. Mm-hmm. So how do Americans negotiate a lower standard of living which doesn't make them all precarious in the same way that Brazilians are precarious? How do you get a good, stable, decent quality of life at a much lower standard of living rather than trying to hang on to the myth that America still produces 70% of the world's manufactured goods with 5% of the population? Much as I dislike the rhetoric around climate change and degrowth, America does have a degrowth problem. Mm-hmm. How does America get gracefully poorer? Not because America is losing, but because the rest of the world is starting to win and it's leveling up and evening out everybody's standard of living. Mm-hmm.
In closing, I always try to end on a more positive note. Do you have any maybe policy solutions or directions that you think things should go in that could lead to more positive outcomes in the future?
I thought that was a positive note. Okay, so let me make a proposal here, right? People are basically enormously fond of bullshit, right? They're fond of bullshit. They're fond of flim-flam. They'll let themselves be conned as long as the person doing the conning is sufficiently entertaining. And as a result, right? The world is filled with idiots. So I have a theory that I got from a friend of mine. A very wise doctor. And he said, look, Vinay, what you've got to realize is up until 300 years ago, it literally did not matter what anybody believed about cause and effect because all of their models were total horseshit, right? You tell me that the harvest is early this year because the moon intersected with Saturn on the third week. I tell you the harvest this year is early because, you know, my daughter saw a goat in a dream. Mm-hmm. Right? We're both wrong, so it doesn't matter which model we believe. See how this works? Mm-hmm. So up until the invention of the scientific method, almost all of our reasoning about cause and effect in the world was automatically an error because we understood practically nothing about how anything worked. Mm-hmm. So the case that he makes is that we shouldn't be surprised that human beings are incredibly gullible and foolish because the kind of truth that we're now able to tell with science is only 300 years old. We haven't evolved to deal with it. So one of the things that I think would be enormously helpful is if we had something that was like a massively more aggressive use of reason in political debate. Mm-hmm. Right? I think there's a pretty good chance that the coronavirus meltdown will kill the public's taste for bullshit in a pretty comprehensive way. Because when we get to the after action reporting on this stuff, you know, White House says don't wear masks is then resolved, you know, 6 weeks later with White House says do wear masks. And in the meantime, how many people have gotten infected and died? Like, excuse me, but this bullshit that was spoken ex cathedra by our government officials appears to have gotten, you know, 670,000 Americans infected, of whom maybe, you know, 28,000 died. Like, that's 6/9/11s worth of death because you were talking bullshit ex cathedra. So I think we might get into a position where people realize that bullshit is fatal. Right, and then we get to climate change, and we get to smoking, and we get to cars, and many other things where we just have enormous amounts of politicized bullshit that people have been throwing at each other without realizing that they're eating away at the fabric of truth. And if what comes out of this is a new allegiance to the truth and a new willingness to audit political statements, whether they're made by your own side or somebody else's side, and simply destroy the people that are lying for a living, that to me is worth doing. Right? Like, you know, citation needed really ought to be the marching banner of all new political movements in the post-COVID era. Because if we had actually relied on the scientific method, practically none of us would die of this thing.
I agree 110% with that. Vinay Gupta, I have to thank you for coming on the podcast. I think you've really provided something different and something very thoughtful to my audience. I want to thank you. And if you want, let my listeners know how they can follow your work.
Sure. So the humanitarian stuff is mostly on a website called My Hope for the World. MyHopeForThe.World. That's where the humanitarian stuff is. Most of my pandemic work is has been moved onto my website as part of our CSR project. So materium.com/CSR. There was one other thing that people want to take a look at. And on that, there is the podcast that really gets into the whole kind of dynamics about labor relations and class war and family structures as it applies to COVID. Because shelter at home is a privilege, right? Being able to quarantine yourself is a privilege. The people that are running our supply chains don't have that luxury, and a lot of them are getting sick, and this is, never mind our medical staff.
I wanted to note too, I've been trying to say that to people. It's a real privilege to be able to work from home, and I think people keep forgetting about that these days. It's very bizarre.
Absolutely. I mean, I will be perfectly honest. Like, nobody I know has got COVID and died. And my personal quality of life has gone remarkably up because, you know, it's just I sit at home and I work and, you know, then I take a break and I watch a movie and then, you know, maybe I do, you know, another couple of calls. And it really feels like those, like, highly productive Saturdays you would get where nobody is in the office and you can just sit down and get a bunch of stuff done. It's been like that for weeks. And I'm just like, you know, is that not the living definition of privilege that we're in the middle of a pandemic and my quality of life has gone up? If that is not like, you know, you could bounce a rock off it privilege, I don't know what is. Mm-hmm. And that's not because I'm rich, because believe me, I'm not. You know, it's because I happen to be of a technical elite that allows me to work on the internet for a living. And, you know, here we are.
But there's also the people that don't have that privilege. And I just get annoyed because I think people are forgetting about them in some ways.
Well, people have been forgetting about them for a long time, right? That's like, true. In terms of how you see this, right, the delivery driver is invisible, the warehouse worker is invisible, and the person who's most invisible of all is the poor Chinese bastard in a factory who's manufacturing this stuff, right? And the inability to understand and hear, I mean, I must pull out the great sledgehammer, right? So, you know, for us in Scotland, from, you know, my time and my place and my culture, you know, factories were what labor was about, right? At the end of the day, the left was about factories and working conditions for people that worked in factories. That is where it was at. And now the people that work in our factories live in another country, right? The proletariat, for the most part, means the Chinese. Mm-hmm. Right? Our proletariat are Chinese for the most part. And because we decided that we weren't going to care about socialism as an international phenomenon anymore, we stopped paying attention to the working conditions of the proletariat that made our lives possible. And there is no greater betrayal than the fact that the American left doesn't have much concern at all for the welfare of Chinese factory workers.
Well, Vinay Gupta, once again, I want to thank you very much for coming on Parallax Views.
Lovely to be here. Have fun, guys. Read more Gandhi.
Well, that does it for this edition of Parallax Views. I hope you enjoyed our conversation with Vinay Gupta. Although I suspect some of you, like myself, were probably a bit adversarial at times. That being said, Parallax Views is all about challenging its audience, and I thought it was at the very least an interesting conversation. As always, you can let me know what you thought about this edition of Parallax Views by dropping me a line on Twitter at @viewsparallax or by email at parallaxviewspod@protonmail.com. Also, please consider supporting me on Twitter. I should be getting out some more bonus content than usual this month. including a bonus show with Vinay Gupta on Nick Land, the sort of bad boy of the so-called Dark Enlightenment and the neo-reactionary movement online. So that should be coming out shortly on patreon.com/parallaxviews. Be on the lookout for it, folks. And of course, you can also hear some of the content Casey and I create. We're starting to do bonus shows, or post-game bonus shows, I should say, in which we give a little commentary and talk off the cuff about the interviews we've been conducting. All that and more on Parallax View's Patreon page, patreon.com/parallaxviews. And with that being said, until next time, you've been listening to Parallax Views with Parallax Views to Parallax Parallax Views with Parallax Views.
The way out is not simply to say don't do it, just to prohibit. It's nothing else. If we don't do it, others will be doing it like crazy. So, you know, we have to confront the problem. But no, basically, I know of the great anxiety problems, new forms of control, but it's also new forms of freedom. This is why I always emphasize that internet and all this new digital stuff, it's a very ambiguous phenomenon, but it's the field of struggle. New forms of enslavement, but at the same time, new incredible forms of freedom. We have to accept the fight with no nostalgia for old, allegedly more authentic communities or whatever. I'm not afraid. I'm not afraid. I'm not afraid. I'm not afraid.